sideways of the sport of figure skating and maybe give you +5 GOE along the way. Let's introduce this week's hosts.
Hi, I'm Evie, and I made the stupid decision not to take any leave from my full-time job during the Olympics, and so I'm extremely fired up, but also ready to take a month-long nap.
I'm Kat, in a similar boat, except I decided to log myself at least take a week off after the Olympics are over, so yay for self-care.
You really made a good decision with that. I feel like I need to go have like a nice tropical vacation after this is all over.
Genuinely need to like decompress after this. Like it feels like every single day has felt like 6 years.
And we're only two individual events in, and it feels like we've been here for months.
So before we begin to talk about the ice dance event, we actually have an update to give you surrounding the doping case regarding Kamila Valieva. So on Sunday, the Court of Arbitration for Sport, or CAS, met for a hearing to determine whether or not the Russian anti-doping agency, or RUSADA's decision to overturn the ban they imposed on Kamila on February 8th after her samples taken on December 25th came back positive was justified. Unfortunately, they chose not to impose any sanctions on RUSADA, the ROC, or Kamila, and she was permitted to compete at the event, which began on Tuesday. Their reasoning for dismissing the case was due to the fact that she was a protected person, aka a minor, according to the World Anti-Doping Agency's code, and that heavy sanctions are not imposed or enforced for these people. They also cited the timing of the test results as the main factor for this ruling, that the wait time in between the sample being received and then tested was the cause of the interference in her possibly competing here. There's one thing in particular that stands out to me in this, and that's that Kamila getting a pass because she's a minor, when we've seen before that other governing bodies like the ISU don't care about age when it comes to enforcing these anti-doping rules. For example, Yeonim Kim of Korea, who incidentally is also at these Olympics, accidentally missed a doping test at JGP Yokohama in 2016, an event she competed at when she was only 13, 2 years younger than Kamila is now. She was unaware that she needed to be tested and was reprimanded by the ISU for doing so. Reading the disciplinary decision press releases for this case versus the one that we've currently seen at this Olympics gives you like such strong whiplash, because you can like clearly see that these athletes are being held to two entirely different standards over what's appropriate for a minor. Furthermore, off the back of this ruling, the IOC announced that if Kamila were to medal at these games, no medal or flower ceremony would take place, and if she were to qualify for the free skate, then an extra woman would also qualify, making it 25 instead of 24 qualifiers. This is all in the case that after CAS holds further hearings for the other violations, remember that this ruling is only about whether or not to reimpose her suspension, then any medals or placements Kamila receives here would be revoked. What's perhaps the most infuriating thing to read in this CAS media release about this decision, which we will add a link to in the episode description, is that the panel apparently considered fundamental principles of fairness and irreparable harm towards the athlete when making this decision. I would argue that permitting Kamila, whose name has been dragged through the mud through countless news cycles at this point, who's had to walk through the mixed media zone with her hood up as to avoid reporters berating her with questions, to seeing footage of her crying during practices when she's struggled, it's not a decision made on the basis of whether or not she could be irreparably harmed by doing so. Like, suspending her and barring her from competition would at least give her a way to escape what must be a truly dizzying amount of scrutiny, which will only continue to get worse if she ends up meddling in just a few days. And to the other point that the panel considered the principle of fairness regarding this resolution, I would argue that it isn't fair to anyone involved here. Like, it isn't fair to Kamila, who is probably having, like, one of the worst moments of her young life right now. But more importantly, it isn't fair to her competitors who have effectively had their Olympic moments like tarnished by this whole affair. Those athletes who have competed clean, who deserve their Olympic moment, something that may only come once in a lifetime. Those other women who will not get their medals until months after the games actually finish because of court proceedings. I would argue that the only way in which this ruling is fair, the only people who truly benefit from all of this, are Kamila's coaching team. To the coaches of Sambo 70 and their ringleader, Eteri Tutberetsi, like, it gives them a pass to continue pushing these literal children to their breaking points, giving them performance-enhancing drugs to maximize any and all potential they might have, and then abandon them as soon as they reach puberty or their bodies literally break. The New York Times investigated this issue and found reports that Kamila was taking two other heart medications, both of which are not banned by WADA, as well as the drug in question, TMZ, which she tested positive for. You cannot argue that a 15-year-old elite-level figure skater could have a heart condition that would warrant her to take 3 separate medications for it and still be able to compete at the level that she does. That is fundamentally impossible. And in refusing to step up to the plate, to impose even the barest minimum of sanctions in the name of athlete safety, the Court of Arbitration for Sport chose not to act. Until the situation is resolved, which may take months, if not years, until sanctions are placed upon Sambo 70 and Ateri Tutberetse, and the full truth about this whole situation is revealed as to the extent of their doping of their athletes, this issue will persist, and it's just not right. We'll continue to provide updates on this whole situation as it progresses through our Twitter, as well as in our further episodes covering the Olympics. So, the ice dance event! It's over! It happened! We've got medalists, new Olympic champions. Wow.
And in a way, did it feel like this ice dance event sort of just felt like the culmination of just everything? Symbolizes what happened this entire quad.
Literally. I mean, it's really funny when you think about how the podium here is exactly the same podium that we had all the way back in 2019 at Worlds.
I was thinking that too. I literally thought that too. And it had a good chance of being the same podium of, like, Montreal Worlds if that had happened.
Yeah, exactly. Like, nothing much has really, like, all of the top teams have stayed kind of persistently in the top throughout the whole year. There haven't been really many shakeups. Like, obviously, last quad, we kind of had the, like, shakeup of Virtue and Moya coming back. It kind of threw things a little off balance. But now this quad has kind of just been, you know, obviously ignoring the disruption of COVID. It's kind of all just been the same storyline.
It really has been. One of the biggest factors in this quad, obviously, is the rise of the Ice Academy of Montreal, or Gadbois. Given that 11 out of the 23 teams that were competing here, at least in the rhythm dance, and I believe 9 out of 20 in the free dance, were from the same school. I was explaining this to my friends over call last night. Whoa, that's so many teams.
It's insane. Considering, like, you compare that to Pyeongchang, there were only 4 Gadbois teams competing at that event. So going from 4 to, like, 11, and these are, you know, it's the Olympics. These are the top teams. Yeah, we talk a lot about, like, you know, how crazy packed that school is, but then you put it into perspective like that, and it's just like, yeah, nearly half the field at this Olympics all train at the same rink with the same coaches and the same choreographers. That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, and honestly, like, I hope that some people this quad kind of realize that the oversaturation at that school is not going to help them, because once you have that many teams that are training together, I mean, obviously you want to be training with the top teams, but there's also, like, you know, the level of attention and the amount that you can stand out among those teams that all plays a role in how well you get scored. So I really hope that some teams reconsider, at least go to different choreographers, or
yeah,
you know,
especially when, like, you talk about, like, teams, especially that represent the same countries, all training in the same rink, then you have to think about, like, how the internal politics of a school like that works. But, like, maybe with the fact that the Ice Academy of Montreal, they've opened up another school now. So now they have 2 different locations, and the other one, which is, you know, headed by Scott, where Carrera and Ponomarenko train. Maybe the fact that they're expanding means that they're going to get more coaches, more choreographers in their arsenal. So maybe that they can, you know, kind of work on providing their teams with more support rather than just have everyone squished in together at one location.
In the end, I think it's just the oversaturation of teams from one school that is kind of stifling some of the creativity that we see in ice dance. And honestly, I'm really hoping that there are some more, yeah, you know, the expansion of, like, more coaches, more choreographers in the field will help kind of rectify that stagnation.
But, like, we talked about, you know, obviously a lot of the top things being from Gadbois. One of the, like, biggest storylines of these last couple of years has been the constant kind of back and forth that we saw between Hubble and Donahue and Chalk and Bates, kind of for that, you know, that top US spot. You had, like, Chock and Vates consistently either winning or coming in the second in 2019 at Nats. But then Hubble and Donahue went on to medal at Worlds in 2019 and then 2021.
For whatever it's worth, like, it seems that, like, Hubble and Donahue have been more successful with the international judges, whereas, you know, maybe the Federation or the U.S. judges seem to favor Chock and Bates more. But I think that the problem with both of them has always been, like, their packaging. I mean, it's not just these two teams. It's a lot of the teams there is trying to find that right way to be packaged. The way that things played out, I can't say that I'm upset, but I've always loved Hubble and Donahue skating. I've always said that, like, you know, they skate so big, they're so fast, like, live, they're so impressive, but I mean, there's only so much that you can appreciate the skating. The programs don't do it for you, so.
I think that the real edge that the, like, they have, and we'll talk about this more later, but, like, Hubble and Donahue definitely had the better set of programs this year in particular.
For sure. For sure. I mean, if they had to pick, like, a season to get it right.
I know. They really picked the right one to actually
yeah,
get some
not all of them did. Not all of them did.
Definitely not. And I feel like, obviously, we had that back and forth between them, but there were some, like, interesting storylines that came out of some other countries, this squad, like, particularly Canada, where we had Piper and Paul, you know, kind of come up right at the start of the quad and cement themselves as, like, not only just, like, a medal contender for smaller events or, like, for Grand Prix, but, like, actually contenders for major medals, like championships and then eventually Worlds.
Yeah, and I remember, because I was at Skate Canada in 2019, when, you do you remember, like, Piper's reaction when they got their scores, like, at
yes.
Skate Canada? They beat Hubble and Donahue there. Like, I think that was the moment where, or at least for me, that I thought, oh, okay, Skate Canada really is going for the Piper and Paul push here.
Yeah.
For world medal, for maybe an Olympic podium. This is, like, the only field that they're competitive in at all, so.
I really love seeing, especially because, you know, Piper and Paul have had such a long career together where they've kind of played, you know, second or third fiddle to other Canadian teams in the field, like Vachon Moyer and Weaver and Poge.
They've been around for a while.
Exactly. And seeing them come into their own here and, you know, really, you know, contend for those major medals has been really nice to watch, I feel.
Although I do also, I don't know, I kind of, like, lament the fact, I think everyone is a really, you know, everyone really fell in love with their Vincent program from the 2018-2019 season. And they've always been known for being the quirky team that did unique things. And I just, I can't help but think that because they started contending for major medals after that season, especially when the field was pretty depleted. A lot of the top teams weren't competing a lot that season. And they thought that because Vincent was so well-loved, they kind of did a derivative version of that dance every season after, and they kind of lost that originality that made them super special,
yeah.
In my opinion. Unfortunately, this free dance is pretty forgettable. Yeah, I just kind of wish that they went back to their more fun programs.
Obviously, the problem is that, like, we had all these teams kind of rise up at the start of this quad, or, like, these major talking points come up, but then obviously everything kind of ground to a halt, because obviously, you know, we are still living in a pandemic, which is, you know, not been fun.
Nope.
But, like, everyone in ice dance and everyone, like, in figure skating in general has been affected by the pandemic and terms of training, but, like, they had major disruptions in a lot of major training camps. Like, I know that Gabois was shut down for a large period of time in, like, 2020, and obviously the Russian training camps kind of still kept going throughout the pandemic, throughout 2020 and 2021, and a lot of them were absolutely, like, ravaged by COVID.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the pandemic affected some teams more than others, depending on, you know, the amount of ice time that they can get, the rink access, and access to choreographers, having to do choreography remotely, coaching remotely even, like, all of these things have an impact. I mean, even the top team, like, even Papadopoulos and Cizarone got COVID, and I, like, in the past two seasons, I feel like I barely see them.
They didn't go to Euros this year, they didn't go to Worlds last year, they went to the Grand Prix, but
they went to the Grand Prix this year, right?
Yeah,
They basically did not compete. the 2020 to 2021 season. You know, I honestly forgot because when I was watching the rhythm dance, I was like, oh, wow, like, we're on the last group already? Like, Papadakis and Cicerone are here. Like, and then I remembered, like, oh, right.
World standings.
Yeah, right, world standings, and, like, they didn't compete, so.
Yeah, it's just, everyone was like, especially last year at the end of the season, obviously, barely anyone had been able to train at the level that they had been consistently at for the last couple of years, so everyone looked really rough last year at Worlds. But, like, I feel like the kind of standard we come to expect from this ice dance field, because it's kind of come back at this Olympics. Like, everyone seems to have gotten back into kind of their training groove now.
But, yeah, shall we just talk about, quickly just go through the medalists?
Yes, definitely. And considering we've been talking for this long and haven't mentioned who got on the podium.
We have Gabriela Papadakis, Guillaume Cicerone. Winning the gold, Victoria Sinisina and Nikita Katsalapov from the ROC winning silver, and Madison Hubble and Zachary Donahue from the U.S. getting on the podium, squeezing in.
It's not that this Olympics ice dance event was boring to watch. It was just, again, very
predictable.
It was just, yeah. I mean, honestly, if you asked me back in 2019 or 2018, like, who I would expect to be on the podium here, I probably could have told you exactly this. And,
yep.
You know, it's just not shocking, not surprising. I mean, you know, dance, you don't usually see giant changes in ordinals like in other disciplines. But it just really, like, it felt amplified here that this, like, this ice dance event in particular was very by the numbers.
Indeed. Yeah, it just feels like this ice dance was more or less just, like, a coronation for Papadakis Cicerone, who were posting massive scores for the last four seasons. It would have taken a major mess up for them to not win the golds, clearly. But, you know, I do want to point out that turning silver into gold has always, you know, there is a level of pressure that comes with that. And, you know, knowing the past Olympic demons, I don't even want to think about how many times they sewed Gabby's dress on.
Like, oh, God, yeah. I can just imagine that the neckline of her dress in the rhythm dance was like, you know, safety pin sewed in completely.
No chances for that.
Like, there was some doubt, like, maybe, like, especially in 2020 when Sinitsyna and Katsalapov won Euros over them, that there could be, like, a bit of a shake-up. But, like, after the team event happened, I was, like, really confident that, you know, Papadakis and Cicerone were going to win.
Team event did not help anyone this time.
No.
Really
no,
did not.
It did not.
At least in ice dance did not help anyone.
Pretty much, no. But you think about it, because, you know, yeah, Sinitsyna and Katsalapov both skated both the rhythm dance and the free dance in the team event, and they kind of, you know, they had problems in the rhythm dance, and then their free dance score was, like, good, but it wasn't the level that they needed to, like, actually challenge what Papadakis and Cicerone could have put out. And then, like, all of the other teams also didn't really have dramatic increases, so it's just, like, what kind of momentum are we setting in this team event? Not much, by the looks of it.
Pour one out to Nikita's back. Got a, like, bless his physio. I was terrified that at some point he was going to drop Victoria. Like, in this past week, his back's not looking good. So I'm glad that he managed to survive. I was real worried when I saw that they were not doing any substitutions for dance. So I feel like, at least to me, past the, like, top five teams or so, they kind of were struggling to place the team. They just kind of, like, were like, oh, all these teams are kind of around the same, so we'll just put one after the other. Like, I mean, now that the free is in reverse order of the short or the rhythm dance, like, it feels like it just did the judges' work for them. They were like, well, if there aren't any major deductions, we'll just put you next up.
Yeah, it felt like they were just kind of squishing everyone together. Like, they had a couple people right at the front, and then everyone was just kind of, like, cramped into the same kind of scoring range. Because I think in the rhythm dance, you had, like, Chok and Bates, Stepanova and Buchan, and then, like, Piper and Paul, and Guinard and Fabry, all in the same, like, low 80s scoring. They just kind of squished together in that same kind of area. And then you had like we had so many scores in the 70s, which was kind of surprising, I found. But like, we talked about it a little bit in the team event episode about how obviously there were some choices about Fed sending certain skaters to the Olympics. Like, obviously, we talked about Team Coco coming here. Unfortunately, they didn't qualify for the free dance. But there were some other teams that were here that, especially at the start of this season, not even the start of the quad, but the start of this season, I don't think any of us expected teams like Davis and Smolkin to get to the Olympics.
In a way, yes. Like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. We did not expect them to be at the Olympics. Yeah, some of the scores that they got. I think that they, I don't think I've ever seen a team. This is like their international debut season, right? So the team, the scores for them have been so wild and fluctuating like crazy. Like they scored over 80 in the rhythm dance at Warsaw Cup, right? They beat out Kana and Dai, and they beat out Green and Parsons at Warsaw Cup. Like
they almost got 200 total points at Warsaw Cup, and that they're for a first year senior team in ice dance. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, and they had only competed at US Classic and Skate Canada, right? Like I think they got like fifth at Skate Canada.
Definitely not a large body of work to suggest a 200, you know, especially because I believe that they had the highest international like debut rhythm dance score of any team in the history of IJS. They got like a 75. It's crazy. You don't see that kind of rapid score increase from juniors to seniors in this that kind of like couple of month span. I think everyone knows that, you know, Diana is a Terry Tutberidze's daughter, so there's a lot there to dissect. A
lot to be said for that. Yeah, explaining this saga, I have to say, just to my friends with the situation with Camila and Diana being here, and like trying to explain, you know, this whole situation sounds completely wild to an outsider. Like, that, you know, ISU has been doing those like explain figure skating to an alien, and I would just try to explain this to them and see how they react.
Impossible. It's just that, especially when you look at some of the other teams in the Russian field, like the Russian domestic field, they are clearly still at that kind of, you know, the very early senior level. You know, their skating skills haven't developed yet. They've got some cool lifts. Their programs aren't the best packaging-wise, but, like, you know, I guess their free dance isn't a terrible choice. Like, Moulin Rouge is a very safe option.
They still fall into the same junior pit traps that I think we've talked about before, where they pick something that's really overdramatic to try to compensate for the lack of interpretation, and it makes you feel more juniorish in the way that you're trying to force a team to skate up to this big music, but because their interpretation is not strong enough, then it falls, like the program itself just falls flat.
And then you have, like, on the other hand, you know, obviously the last couple of years, there's always been the discussion around the Spanish ice dance spot, because there's usually only one at major events, and the constant battle between Smart and Diaz and Hurtado and Caliavin. It's just the constant back and forth that's right. Been driving us all crazy, and the fact that they only ended up qualifying one Olympic spot last year really just sent so many of us over the edge.
That's so, so devastating. Honestly, they both deserve to go. I think that if you looked at the trajectory of the last quad, I think it was pretty obvious that the Spanish Federation was pushing Smart and Diaz over Hurtado and Caliavin just based on their international scoring and, you know, going the head-to-heads. But they both deserve to go. I don't know if it's because the Spanish Fed was like, well, Hurtado and Caliavin already got the last Olympics, so now you get to go. It's just like that.
Apparently they decided via, like, the aggregate scores that they like had throughout the season, and then they used Spanish nationals and Euros as the like main deciding factors, and yeah, it was really close. Like the total scores for across the events was really close between them, but Smart and Diaz managed to win out.
Yeah, I mean, this is the best set of programs that they've had this entire quad.
It feels like, I feel really torn between it because, like, I can acknowledge the fact that Hurtado and Caliavan are the obvious, like, pick for, like, the technical side of things.
Skate and hold, they're faster, yeah.
But I don't enjoy their programs as much. Like, their packaging, I feel like, isn't as memorable as Smart and Diaz. Like, and that's been, like, kind of consistent through the last couple of years. Especially this season, they definitely had the strongest set of programs over Sarah and Kirill. So I'm not at all surprised. But yeah, like you said, would have liked to have seen both of the teams here just, honestly, just to avoid all of the drama. If only they had qualified. Because they were really, they almost placed high enough at Worlds to qualify for two spots. I think they were one placement off doing that. So
yeah. Oh, curses. We could have had both. They both deserve... I really hope that Sarah and Kirill keep going, though. I think that... I don't know if Smart and Diaz have made any statements. I really hope that, you know, maybe we'll see the rise of more Spanish teams in the future. Qualify more teams. Don't have to deal with this lack of spots.
And I feel like also another thing that has to be said is, like, there were teams that obviously didn't make the Olympics. And one of them that I kind of... that when I first heard about all of this stuff going on, I was kind of shocked because, you know, there's the Lithuanian ice dance spot, which was earned by Alison Reed and Salius Ambrulovicius. Like, you know, they couldn't come here because Alison didn't get granted Lithuanian citizenship, even though she applied two separate times last year. Like, there was apparently no substance for her application to be granted based off special merit.
Really devastating. You know, working your whole life, you know, these past few years, like, it's been a hard quad for everyone. And, you know, with the singular goal of the Olympics in mind, like, it's really, really sad that they weren't able to make it.
Because they've been competing for Lithuania since, like, 2017, I believe. And, like, they finally managed to place high enough at Worlds last year to, like, secure that spot. Like, they didn't even have to go to Nebelhorn for it. They managed to get it at Worlds. You know, they qualified that spot for Lithuania, but unfortunately, that just, you know, all that work wasn't enough to grant Alison that citizenship. And so they sent another team who is a fairly new team, and unfortunately, they finished last in the rhythm dance, did not qualify for the free. And you just kind of think about what could have been, because I feel like Alison and Salius definitely could have qualified for the free if they were here.
Absolutely.
Shall we go into talking about the rhythm dance a little bit more?
Rhythm dance, yes. Evie, how do you feel about the theme that they picked this year?
Honestly, I was really excited when they first announced that they were going back to Midnight Blues and Urban Dancing, because, like, I feel like there were a lot of really iconic programs the last time it was used in 16-17. Like, there were so many good programs that year. We had, like, the Shibs doing That's Life. We had Virtue Moya's Prince program. So I was really excited for this, especially considering it was the Olympics, you know, a big spotlight. I was really excited that the teams would kind of bring it and, like, have some really interesting programs. But
we already spoke about the Gadbois hegemony and the lack of innovation in the choreography here. And it really stands out here, I think, because, you know, this program is a lot more technical. So there's already less room, slightly less room for there to be, you know, huge variations. And it just really stands out, I think, in the rhythm dance.
Especially because we know for a fact that, like, Gadbois has Sam Chouinard on their team, who's a dancer. And I know that a lot of the Gadbois rhythm dancers use choreography by him. And I mean, when you're choreographing for that many top teams, it's understandable that you're going to run into problems with not sticking too close to a certain formula or making sure that some teams don't have, you know, similar feels to others. There's just so much crowding in that one rink. And, like, to be fair, they did like vary the styles of dances that, like, the teams do. Like, some teams did, like, more disco, some teams did, like, rock, you know, they got a more diverse set of music. But still, I just felt like so many of the rhythm dances this year were really just kind of unmemorable, which is really upsetting, because, again, this theme, it could have really shown another side to ice dance that we haven't seen at the Olympics before. Like, we haven't had a theme like this before.
Yeah, I think, I can't remember who it was on the commentary. I think it was maybe Tessa who was saying about how hip-hop in urban style is very, can be difficult to translate to the ice just because, like, the wide variety of, like, arm movements. I mean, these ice dancers obviously are, like, some of the most coordinated people ever, having to, you know, do all of their fancy footwork as well as the arm movements. Even then, it can be really, really tough to execute properly, execute well, which is why sometimes some of the teams, they're executing the arm work really well, but then there's nothing going on in the feet. And so, like, that's just defeats the whole purpose of ice dance, and especially in a more technical program. It just doesn't work.
I felt that with, like, LaJoie and Lagar, their rhythm dance, their Funky Town rhythm dance, where I noticed that, oh, their, like, upper body movements are really dynamic and really snappy, but there was basically nothing going on in their lower bodies that really quite, like, it was distracting a little bit. Even though that program, I feel, is still really fun.
Right.
They really sell it. But yeah, I totally get what you mean by that.
Yeah, it's just the movement repertoire sometimes, like, doesn't translate as well. But I think that given the right choreographer, maybe going to an actual urban street style choreographer, you know, at least there would be more creativity.
And of course, there's the obvious problem at the moment that, like, sourcing those kind of choreographers might be hard because of COVID, not being able to get them, like, to work with the teams in person. Maybe they might only be able to do it.
Really makes you want to cut some slack to some of these teams just because it is really hard to find choreographers and find time. And going to Sam Chouinard is just basically out of convenience. It's like, well, they're already at my school. Why do I need to get a private tutor?
Yeah, exactly. And that's not to say that there aren't good programs in this field for the rhythm dance. Like, I really like Hubble and Donahue's Janet Jackson rhythm dance. I feel like that's probably my pick of, like, the best rhythm dance this season.
Yeah, obviously, they're iconic backslide, knee slides.
The amount of control that you need and the power in your knees and, like, all of your leg muscles to be able to get that low, crazy.
And the amount of ice coverage that they get just from that one edge, man. Really impressive.
And, like, even right from the beginning of the program, like, it really grabs your attention right away.
Although the moaning part in the middle, like,
I know, yeah.
I had some friends, like, asking me, like, is there moaning?
Like, I feel like their team event scape was probably the cleaner one out of the two. It was a little bit unpolished in the individual. They didn't get quite all of their levels, I believe. But it's still a really excellent program for them. And again, like you said earlier, if they picked a really good season to have two really good programs.
Yeah. Do it for the Olympics, guys. Do it for the Olympics.
I feel like the tech panel in the rhythm dance was pretty harsh throughout the first three groups, especially. It was noticeable, like, barely anyone got above a level two in either the pattern or step sequences. There were lots of level one patterns in particular. Which, you know, and it kind of stayed that way throughout the event. Like, there was some, obviously the scores did get significantly higher in the last two groups of the rhythm dance. But I feel that was more an effect of the judges going buck wild on GOE rather than the levels. You know, especially, the levels at this event, I feel like, were fairly consistent with what you would expect, rather than, say, like, a Worlds 2019, where the tech panel went completely crazy and basically gave everyone clean levels.
It's like, it's a level four for you, level four for you, and you get a level four.
No, it was very much, it was a little bit more scrutinized here, which, you know, is good. We like it when levels are called. Hooray. But yeah, it's just, it's more that the judges were kind of going crazy on the grade of executions here.
That's basically where you find your variation. It's just, like, the crazy PCS and the crazy grade of execution. It's also where most of the politicking comes out.
The too. Politicking, yeah.
Yeah, in ice dance, basically, you just politic based on, like, giving higher PCS and higher GOE, even to elements that don't get, like, all the levels.
And we will definitely go into later on.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, especially when you look at the top two placements in the rhythm dance. When you look at Papadakis and Cicerón and Sinitsyna and Katsalapov. Like, I agree with where they ended up. the scoring for both, like, obviously, Papadakis and Cicerón scored a world record on the rhythm dance. Good for them. But, like, to the extent that they scored, like, the amount of 10s on their protocol sheet, the amount of 4s and 5s on their protocol sheet, was it really warranted? It's hard to say.
Yeah. I mean, I am now curious to see how they plan on scoring the future team. How's any team gonna touch them? They've already basically maxed out, right? For the most part, they've completely maxed out the total, the scores in both programs.
And it's not that I disagree with them winning the rhythm dance or winning overall, because I do think that out of the skates that we saw at this event, they were definitely the cleanest. But I feel like with the rhythm dance, especially when it comes to if teams have similar levels, then at the end of the day, it kind of comes down to personal preference over what you like more in terms of skating style. Like, Papadakis and Cicerón have really great knee bend and make everything look super easy versus, like, Sinitsyn and Katsalapov or even, like, Hubble and Donahue, who are more, like, you know, big sweeping movements and speed and, like, really long lines and things like that.
And I mean, I really appreciated that they went for, like, whacking and tutting for their rhythm dance. They're obviously their greatest strength is trying to, like, show off their lines and their fluidity and their lightness, and this program is definitely not in their comfort zone. A lot more sharp movements, and they still pulled it off pretty well, so, you know, props to them.
And I feel also like with Sinitsyn and Katsalapov's rhythm dance, I'm not a fan of the music that they chose. I'm not really a fan of Nikita's shirt in the rhythm dance. You know, that's a choice, a costume choice. But I feel like the choreography and, you know, it really showed off just how good their basic skating skills are. It really highlighted their strengths in that respect.
Feels like everyone has been saying that, you know, Vika has had the biggest glow up in skating skills in the past couple of years. And it's true. Like, she's definitely, like, one of the best ice dancers in the field right now. I gotta say, you know, their free dances are never, like, they kind of always go for the same style of, like, classic free dance. But this one honestly kind of grew on me a little bit as the season went on. I am not exactly sure why. Also, there's, like, this part in the middle where they do the back crossovers, like, up the midline, and kind of, like, reminded me of, like, Grisha Kapotov, and I'm like, you know what, this is actually kind of nice.
I feel like that this free dance is probably the best one that they've had in the quad.
For sure.
That being said, I'm not a fan of the choreographic step
sequence.
This
choreographic steps! Oh my god, okay, I laugh every single time they happen, but it's just like the music cut. It's the music cut just suddenly, like, cutting to this, like, fast, like, electronic violin style from this, like, you know, very classical.
When I first heard it, I knew that the free dance was Rachmaninoff. But when I first heard that particular section, and especially with the way that they were moving their arms in the choreography for that, I thought that they switched to river dance, because that was the vibe that I was getting with the violin, you know, and the kind of, you know, the arm movements they were doing in the choreographic step sequence. I was just like, did we have a sudden, are we an island now? I'm very confused. And, like, speaking more on the free dances at this event, I feel like, you know, Papadakis and Cicerón, I don't think that this was their strongest free dance of this quad, at least in my opinion, from, like, my personal taste. I think that my favorite one that they had in the last couple of years was
the duet.
Yeah, exactly, duet. Just Sunday afternoon. I feel like that was, and I'm not a, you know, I've said many times, I'm not particularly a huge fan of their skating style. However, that free dance really did, you know, show off the best in their skating. But I do appreciate that they went for a tango here. It's a bold choice. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, it did, they had a little bit more skating and hold, which was kind of nice. But yeah, it feels like they definitely did want to still default to something that was more on the flowing and lyrical side. I mean, tango is not the most lyrical, but they still picked, like, a rather slow tango so that they could still get those, you know, those lines and extensions in.
I believe that they described it, or someone described it, as a deconstructed tango, and I would like someone to explain to me exactly what that means, because...
Yeah, I'm not sure, but mostly just because tango is very much fancy footwork. You know, like, very much fancy footwork and in hold, and there's, you know, there's not that much of it in their free dance. So it's like they're doing contemporary style dancing to tango music, which, you know, honestly, I don't know what to say. Like, it's, again, it's the style that works for them. Does it need to be rewarded to the high heavens like they got? I don't know. I don't think so.
I mean, yeah, looking at the protocols after the fray, they didn't get a single grade of execution point below a 4. Everything was in the 4s and 5s. Which, like looking at that, am I surprised? Absolutely not. I know what to, like, I've come to expect this kind of thing. This is what the judges have been telling us throughout this entire quad. That Papadakis and Cizeron are the ultimates. They are the top of the field.
There's room for an increase, I guess, in base value. But the GOEs, they clearly tried, like, for, like, so many of these elements, even if they take out one of the scores, right, like, it's still going to be, like, 5s across the board. But, like, for the curve lift and for the twizzles, they got perfect. Honestly, when I watched those twizzles, I thought, whoa, those are the best twizzles I think I've ever seen them done. Like, so...
They were really good.
Yeah. Especially because, like, Gabby in particular, used to really wobble a lot on the twizzles. They used to be a little dicey.
They've definitely stabilized that, yeah.
Stabilize, sync, and in sync, gray ice coverage, and close together. So I honestly thought that those twizzles were, like, the best they'd ever done.
But even if you look at, like, the PCS that they got in the fray dance, like, just looking at the protocol sheet, they got only 9.75s and 10s, and they got a perfect 10 in composition. Their total PCS was 59.40, so 0.6 of a perfect PCS score. Like, what kind of message does that send to the rest of the field?
Yeah, how are they going to score the rest? Like, yeah, again, there's more to be desired in terms of, like, base value. But who is going to be the team that can even approach that with maximum base value? And I don't even know. That's the only way that the world record's going to be broken, is someone approaching those PCS with higher base value.
And, like, we talk about free dancers and the programs that we've seen here, but I feel like overall, the whole field has kind of been moving towards kind of replicating that Gadbois, Montreal style, you know, the more lyrical style programs with significantly less kind of skating and hold. And overall, like, decrease in difficulty.
But then you see the teams being scored like that, and it's just like, yeah, I want some of that.
Yeah, of course, like, I'm not knocking that decision that so many teams have chosen to go with these kind of programs, because it's obvious that those programs are the ones that are being rewarded more by the judges. So, like, of course it makes sense that you see that kind of shift in the field.
There needs to be some sort of judging overhaul, which I don't even know how to, like, describe, because it's not gonna happen. I know that I'm just putting that out into the ether and it's never gonna happen, but
absolutely not. I've lost faith in the ISU and the system as a whole to actually have the, like, the want to fix itself.
The thing is that, in theory, I think deep down that the scoring system can be implemented in a way that is more fair, but it's just not being used that way. You know, even the same thing in singles, which, like, you know, having, like, these cues and, like, edge calls and under rotations, etc., calling these things, like, there is a way to, especially with the quad revolution, like, there is a way to implement it so that, you know, even if you do get, like, the higher base value and you ding them for the under rotation and then, like, you just subtract a bunch of GOE, it's that, you know, that would at least be more fair than, you know, a skater doing, like, an under rotation or, like, a, you know, a borderline jump on a quad and then just giving them massive GOE just because they did it, you know?
Yeah, especially with, like, obviously the last couple of years, at the start of this quad, we had the change from +-3 to +-5 GOE. I feel like ice dance has been the discipline that's kind of been affected the most in regards to, like, the way that the scoring has kind of shifted. Like, obviously there's been dramatic, like, ways that the scoring for +5, -5 has affected, like, singles and pairs. But you look at the ranges that the majority of the top teams are being rewarded in GOE, and, like, all of them are getting, like, 3s, 4s, and 5s, when even if the levels themselves aren't great. Like, it doesn't matter if you score a level one or two in a step sequence, because you're going to get the high, if you're from the right federation or you have that, you know, reputation behind you, you're going to get the really high GOE that's going to balance it out anyway. It's why you see some teams with that struggle getting the levels still scoring high, because you still get them, see them getting the crazy GOE.
Ice dancing in particular, because politicking is so prominent in the ice dance field that sometimes the scoring just feels a little bit more incomprehensible sometimes. Incomprehensible yet still predictable, which is how I would describe ice dance scoring, really.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. I feel like, I don't know when it was, which year we did it, but I vividly remember a few years ago talking about how if the ISU really wanted to fix ice dance scoring, or they wouldn't change the grade of execution, they would just change the way that levels are scored and increase the difference between each level. Because right now it's only for most levels, it's only a 0.5 to 1. And imagine the difference that could make, especially in the rhythm dance, when, you know, you've got the pattern dancers. If you increase the differences to maybe 3 points, three or four points between each level, imagine the difference in standings that we would get in each segment just based off the levels. Because levels, if the judges are accurately awarding them, which is a whole other can of worms, you know, you have to rely on the fact that the tech panel is actually doing their job, which sometimes they're not. That's way more objective, on a base level, than grade of execution or PCS will ever be, because it's, you know, it's concrete. You have a way to count steps and turns to award a level versus the judging panel giving grade of execution arbitrarily or based off the GOE chart. You have the tools there to give an accurate score for a level that could foreseeably significantly change the standings in one segment of the event. And they're not doing it. They're just instead decided to boost the amount of GOE you could give a skater. And that's why we've seen the increase in the scores over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and then obviously the PCS scoring as well. The PCS scoring feels even more I almost don't even want to look at them ever. I don't think anyone ever talks about PCS anymore, because it's just kind of all the ice dancers basically get all around there somewhere.
It's honestly, it's almost worthless to look at PCS now.
Right.
You look at it, it's rarely ever representative of what we actually see on the ice.
That's what I was saying. I don't ever see anyone talk about ice dancer PCS anymore, because it's just, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, exactly. And, you think about the way that the scoring is trained at this quad, and you think about, obviously we said that it's going to be basically impossible for anyone to beat Papadakis and Cizeron's world records, foreseeably in the next couple of years.
I will be so curious if someone manages to do it, because right now it's just who?
Exactly. There's, at the moment, there's basically, we haven't seen anyone come close to it. I guess it's Sinitsyn and Katsalapov have come close, but they haven't gotten to the same degree of perfect, scores that the French have. But, you think about other teams in the field that have kind of risen throughout these last couple of years. I think, Fear and Gibson are a really good example of the fact that, even if you don't have, they're not exactly technicians. Their skating skills aren't as strong as some of these other teams. They consistently don't hit the levels in the step sequences and the patterns as well as some of these other teams. However, they're still scoring quite high in both segments, just purely on the basis that their GOE is usually pretty high, and because their reputation has gotten better over the last couple of years, they're also getting that PCS bump. So they could very well become serious contenders in the next couple of years as the field around the top kind of clears out, just on the basis that they're getting that reputation scoring and the GOE that's, representative of that reputation. It's just, and it doesn't make sense. I really like their programs most years, but I do not agree with the way that they are scored most of the time, because it's just not representative of the level of skill that they're currently at. They definitely are a team with potential, but at the moment the judges are rewarding them to the point that there's no real need for them to actively invest in improving because they're already getting those scores. They're already getting those placements.
And it's just going to be more of the same. Like, skaters take feedback from the judges and what the scores they're getting are. And if the scores are in the ballpark of, like, what they want, why would they change anything? You know, like, you know what they say, like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So
exactly. And there's, like, yeah, there's no incentive for the ISU to really change the way that dance is scored, especially with the, like, the main federations in power in the ISU that are, like, benefiting from these trends in scoring. I don't see them without, like, substantive pressure from, like, smaller federations, but that's never going to affect any change in the ISU, I feel. It's just going to kind of be a mess until, like, something inevitably boils over and they realize that, oh, hey, we've been awarding everyone way too high scores. We need to press the reset button or something like that.
What else is there to say? That's literally the predicament that we're in.
It's sad that the scores are like this, that, like, ice dance as a discipline is fundamentally broken in terms of scoring, and there's foreseeably no way that they're actually going to fix it. Is as a fan of the discipline, it's really sad to see.
Yeah, I just hope that someone will break through this. The scoring haze, this choreography stagnation, just everything. Like, I think ice dance clearly needs an overhaul.
Yeah, and it's sad, especially thinking about this season, because, like, I know we've had really good programs this quad. Like, some of those free dances in particular this quad have been really strong from a lot of the top teams that we've seen at the Olympics. Like, obviously we spoke about Vincent from Piper and Paul, but there's also, like, the, you know, Fearon Gibson's disco free dance from 2018-19. Imagine that having an Olympic moment. That's a program that deserved an Olympic moment,
yes,
I feel.
Yes, absolutely.
Even, like, Guinart and Fabry, their Space Oddity program, Stepanova and Buchan's Beth Hart.
Am I the One? One of my faves.
Even, like, Chalk and Bates bringing back their Fever program. That would have been great. I would have even taken the Canadanes doing Spanish Caravan again.
We really had it good in 2018, 2019. I gotta say, thinking back on it, we actually had so many great programs that season.
We really did. I think we kind of took it for granted.
We absolutely did. You know, I remember thinking, like, even the Tango Romanticas, I kind of missed them. Even some of the musicals, man, like, they're kind of campy, but, like, you know, I feel like the public could have, like, bopped along to them at the very least.
But there's still, like, there was still some free dances this season that I personally enjoyed.
Yes.
I liked, especially here, I really liked Stepanova and Buchan's Romeo and Juliet free dance.
Uh-huh.
I was, because, like, obviously they've had a significant rise over this quad, really becoming top European contenders. And obviously this was their first time going to the Olympics because they unfortunately had to miss out in 2018. But, like, honestly, when I first heard they were doing Romeo and Juliet, I was kind of a little disappointed just because I was like, okay, they're picking something safe for the Olympic year. But I feel like with the specific route that they went with their packaging and the music choices, like the music cut they went, they really managed to make it their own.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like where I was talking about how juniors pick really dramatic stuff like Moulin Rouge, or like Romeo and Juliet's another one that a lot of juniors like to do because it's like big music that they don't have to, like, do a lot of interpreting for. But this one feels like slightly more subtle. It's not the big standout, even like Stepanova Buchan did do Moulin Rouge right before. It wasn't like super duper flashy or anything. And I kind of like that, like, subtlety to it. It's like, it's still Romeo and Juliet, but yeah, definitely felt like they put their own spin on it.
One of my favorite free dances here at the Olympics, because I hadn't really seen Turkula and Vesluis's free dance much this year. That opening lift that they have right at the start of the program, it's a stationary lift into a rotational lift. That's crazy. Like, the amount of, like, core strength you need to go from a stationary to rotational instead of the other way around is insane. And the fact that they do it so stably.
Absolutely. It's so great. And especially since their free dance is extremely floaty and lyrical and just very, very light is, like, their style, and still being able to pull off. I mean, we didn't even talk that much about the lifts this past quad, just being very, like, simple positions and holds. But being able to pull off such a difficult technical lift even, you know, though their program is still this, like, lyrical, beautiful, gorgeous program, they deserve props.
And they're the first Finnish dance team to actually qualify for the Olympics since, like, 1994. So, good for them. And the fact that they were both previously single skaters as well is a nice little fun fact about them.
And, oh my god. I mean, we gotta talk about Wang Lu, right? Like, I mean,
what?
I have...
Us talk about them? Never.
I mean, I love them already, and I have a soft spot for the Piano Guys, and I love Kung Fu Piano, so I was like, oh, this is brilliant for me. This is a choice made for me. I just really love that program and the way it builds, and I'm so glad that, you know what, we bag on skaters for using the same lifts all the time, but when you have an iconic lift like that, that's so difficult, and especially with, like, Shin Yu's, like, broken hand from two seasons ago, and they're still doing
it. Oh, God,
it,
yeah.
Like, I don't care. Bring it back every time.
Considering they, like, they took it out last year, you know, when they were still dealing with those injuries, and... they replaced it with, like, a lift of similar difficulty still. But just seeing it back here, like, literally during the team event when I watched the free dance, A, I was very emotional to begin with because, you know, they didn't get to skate the free dance at Pyeongchang at all, either in the team event or the individual. And they got to skate it twice here. So already close to tears. But then as soon as they got to the straight line lift, I was just tears, instant waterfalls. I was crying my eyes out because I was just like, they, you know, not only are they having, like, the skates of their lives out here on home ice with a really, you know, a great crowd for, the crowd has been really receptive to their home skaters, in the last couple of events, which has been really nice to see, but, like, just seeing them return to that lift, return to that form has just, it just got me so emotional.
Right, yeah, they really have had a lot of struggles. I mean, they had to leave Canada, basically, and train full-time in China. So their coaches could really only get to them, you know, late at night or early in the morning. And so they're one of those teams that have been really, really impacted by the pandemic. Same with the choreography. Like, they had to do all their choreography remotely. So the fact that they were able to pull it out and make, like, four great performances here at the Olympics on home ice.
Yeah, they should really be proud of themselves. And, hey, it definitely sounds like that they're planning on skating and continuing to skate.
I really hope so. I you know, I hope that this next quad will give, you know, more opportunities to the Chinese ice dancers and kind of push that field, because it's really, like, emotional for me seeing that, like, China has an expanding ice dance field, because for a long time, Chinese skaters have always been kind of derided for being, like, emotionless and expressionless and, like, lacking the artistic side of, like, skating. But, you know, we have ice dancers that are competitive, and that's super cool. And, like, I honestly really like Gennard and Fabry's Atonement Free Dance. I know it's not for everyone, but I think that they're the only ones that can pull off being the schmaltzy team. Like, they're married. And I think that they're just, like, adorable, and they're amazing skaters. And, yes, they should probably have a green dress. Probably would have made the program more iconic, but... I honestly think that is, and then they put the Song of the Sparrow at the end, so.
That is, yeah, I love that piece of music so much. I agree that, like, I'm also a really big fan of this free dance. I'm surprised that so many people seemingly aren't big fans of it.
People find them kind of boring sometimes. I mean, maybe because I've seen them live a couple of times, I'm always so impressed whenever I see them live that I'm like, oh, okay, never mind. I reconsider the thought that they are boring, like, because they're so impressive when you watch them skate live. Yeah, and I really hope that they must be sticking around, right? Because the next Olympics are in Milan, so...
I don't know. I mean, they're both in their 30s now.
Both in their 30s. They are both. But the Italian ice dance field is also wide open.
This is very true, yeah.
So they have an opportunity to go and compete at... And, you know, like, Barbara Fusarpoli and Maurizio Margaglio were in Torino, right? I mean, what happened there was kind of... tragic, but, you know, but, you know, I feel like that could be, like, a small full circle moment for them to go and compete. And then we got to talk about, I really love Hawaiian Baker's Japan Free Dance, too. For me, Hawaiian Baker, I have always just had a soft spot for them. I'm so glad that they really, really pulled it out these last two competitions, the US Nats and the Olympics. Like, these two have had such an up and down, this quad, right?
Mm.
The field, the ice dance field was super open in the beginning of 2018. Like, the field was so open in the beginning of the 2018 season, and so they kind of lucked their way into Grand Prix Final because they won an HK and got fourth in France, I think it was. But because they were one of the teams that kind of, like, migrated to Gadbois in the beginning of the quad, they kind of got drowned out by at every other competition, and they got drowned out by the other two ice dancers. Like, the ice dance field in the U.S. is pretty big. And then with the concussion, with Caitlin's concussion, and they had, like, a whole bunch of other health issues, they haven't really been able to compete a lot, so they kind of lost, like, all their momentum. And the few times that they actually did compete, they kept messing up things, and so they weren't able to, like, seize any momentum, but they, and so, like, there was a lot of question now. Like, Hawaii and Baker were always that solid number four team when the Shibs were around, and number three team with the Shibs gone in the U.S., and it was kind of like a question of, like, okay, are they actually going to, you know, are they going to, like, falter? Are they going to lose that, like, number, that solid number three spot to a different team? And they really, they delivered when it counted, and I'm really glad that they were able to make the Olympics here. So, and they did really well, too.
Definitely. I feel like that the next couple of years for them, if they continue to skate, which I'm positive that they're probably going to stick around, they're both pretty young, that, like, this next couple of years will be really interesting to see how they track both internationally and nationally, because obviously Hubble and Donahue are going to be retiring. That's leaving, you know, a significant gap in the top of the U.S. field.
Yeah, Green and Parsons are there, going to be there to chop.
Yeah,
at the,
they're definitely going to be at the heels of Hawaii and Baker in the next couple of years, or at least, or even surpassing them. Just seeing the kind of changes that the field could go undertake in the U.S. dance field with the amount of, you know, with the retirements, and, like, we're not sure if Chalk and Bates are going to be retiring at the end of the season. They haven't made any official announcements, but considering both their ages and the injury problems that they've had in this past year with, like, their, both that they've been dealing with, like, back spasms, things like that, I wouldn't be surprised if they only stuck around for maybe another season or two. I personally don't see them going to the next Olympics. Even though I think Scott was trying to convince Evan to go to his fifth Olympics or something. With Hawaii and Baker, with Green and Parsons, you know, we've got that kind of question of how the US dance field is kind of going to look in the next quad. I feel like we haven't had this much of a, like, there's a significant gap that needs to be filled, and it'll be interesting to see how, which top team rises to the occasion to kind of fill that gap.
I mean, Green and Parsons have set themselves up, like, perfectly winning four continents and coming super close to, they beat Hawaii and Baker in the rhythm dance at US Nats. So
it's funny when you think about the fact that Hawaii and Baker won four continents in the last Olympic year, and now Green and Parsons won four continents in this Olympic year.
Yep.
So we're, you know, and now we're talking about them and comparing them.
Yep, setting themselves up perfectly, I'd say. So we'll see.
Yeah. Well, I know a lot of people were arguing, even some of us here at ITL were, like, arguing that Green and Parsons should have gotten one of the Olympic spots.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, I think I would have been fine either way, but I do have a more sentimental soft spot for Hawaii and Baker. I mean, Green and Parsons are only, like, 2-year-old, like, team right now, right? They're super new. But, like, they're, like, super impressive. I mean, I watched them at their first Grand Prix in Skate America, and I was, like, completely blown away by how good Caroline was, because I was not sure. I had never really seen her. She was only 16 at the time, and I hadn't really seen her compete before, and I was really blown away by the maturity of her interpretation at such a young age.
Yeah. And talking about, like, other potential teams in the U.S. field, you've also got, like, Carrera and Ponomarenko, who have kind of had a rough go of it this year.
Well, another team that I have a tragic soft spot for. I just...
I mean, yeah, they've kind of... They've had a bit of a weird year. I mean, they're currently training at the second location of the Ice Dance Academy in Montreal with Scott Moyer. And I know that their rhythm dance has made the rounds quite a bit in the last couple of months. Their bat dance rhythm dance. Not necessarily in a good way. It's a little polarizing.
Yeah, I just, I don't know if that was Scott's decision or was their decision or their choreographers. Like, I just really hope that Scott has better taste than these programs suggest. And maybe I'd give it, this is like his first season really as a coach, so I'll give him a pass,
especially because I mean they have never really been the strongest team in terms of levels and on the technical side of things, but their scores in particular this season, I don't know if they're indicative of like their training situation, which hasn't been great over the last couple of years because of COVID. They really took a dip, and that's why they were never really considered competitive for that Olympic spot this year. But you know, obviously, there's a new quad approaching. They're both still a really young team, so they have that potential. And again, if, you know, depending on how their coaching situation goes, depending on if Christina can actually still get her U.S. citizenship, because I believe that she still doesn't have it.
I feel really bad for their citizenship situation. I also wonder if, you know, that, like, that Tanith and Charlie have started, like, their Michigan Ice Dance Academy too. I'm really curious to see now whether the ice dance field will start migrating over there and what that's going to look like, what their coaching and packaging and just in general style is going to be if they end up having some top teams training over there.
Yeah.
I mean, they're brand new, so yeah. Who knows?
Might take a little bit to establish themselves, yeah.
But, I mean, what better time to do it than in the beginning of an Olympic quad? But it really does suck that, like, especially for some of, the, like, the junior teams, they've had very little chances to compete these past two seasons.
I know.
The COVID affecting the Junior Grand Prix. Even now Junior Worlds is being pushed back. This is really, really harmful to the junior teams who already don't really have that many chances to get international competition time. So it's just really unfortunate.
Of course, we had the Junior Grand Prix this year, but like, you have to think about the fact that all of the events took place in Europe. So there was obviously the problem of traveling for some teams that either couldn't afford it or didn't want to take the risk of traveling internationally right now during the pandemic, which is totally understandable. You also had, like, Japan, who didn't send any of their skaters to any of their Junior Grand Prix, and so, like, none of their skaters or teams got any experience this year. And, yeah, and I mean, the juniors really, for their international season, only have the Junior Grand Prix and then Junior Worlds every year. So, hopefully, the ISU will actually be able to hold Junior Worlds in May, like they're planning to, with the postponement. Because it's going to be really detrimental to those skaters if they're not going to be able to get that experience. Like, obviously, you know, they need to hold this event in the safest way possible, and Omicron is obviously, you know, interfering with that, but the junior skaters deserve this time on the international stage, especially, you know, the junior ice dancers. We always say that junior ice dance is the best and most valid discipline in figure skating. That is still very true. And I very much miss getting to watch a lot of it, especially in the last year, because obviously working full time and European time schedules for events are not good for Australia. Yeah. So I've been able to watch very little junior ice dance this year, which sucks.
Yeah. The junior ice dancers, honestly, God bless them. Bringing some of the creativity back.
And that's not to say that, like, there aren't teams still bringing creativity to the field. Like, obviously, we have some of the younger teams that were at this Olympics that were really bringing new things to it. Like, obviously, one of our, like, top favorite junior teams from the last couple of years was Kazakova and Revia from Georgia. And now that they made the transition to senior, they made it to the Olympics here. And that, so good. So good to see them.
It just feels so weird because it felt like two seasons ago we were seeing them everywhere. Like, they were doing both junior and senior events. So, like, they competed constantly, and then ever since COVID, it's just, like, haven't seen them at all. So I was just like, whoa, it's, like, my first time seeing them in such a long time. But they've had, like, issues with, like, injuries and stuff, right?
Yeah. And then they've had training issues due to COVID. They've been through a lot. They basically skipped the entirety of last season.
I mean, they weren't the only one, but they, yeah, it just felt so jarring to, like, see them so much and then not at all.
But they came back this season. They went to Nebelhorn. They scored the spot for Georgia for Ice Dance. Unfortunately, I feel like, and this is probably just due to the lack of training time, the lack of international competition experience they've had in the last year, I feel like their skating in general has kind of declined in quality. But again, I'm not going to hold that against them just because of their circumstances. Like, it's completely understandable that they've gone through that kind of shift. But even through that, they still have, like, really interesting program choices and really fun elements. Like, they have some of the coolest choreographic, like, elements and lifts in the entire field, I feel.
Yes, yeah.
Like, they have this really cool lift right at the start of their free dance where Maria's, like, suspended in a stationary lift, but they're both, like, she's holding onto Gregory's arms, like, behind her back. They're, like, crisscrossed, and, like, I just looked at it, and, like, the amount of core strength she must have to be able to keep herself in that position while spinning. Oh my god, I could never.
Yeah, and yeah, I really hope that they, you know, they keep working and they keep growing and they can make the next Olympics. They're so young. They have a bright future. So
they definitely do. It's just a matter of them getting that experience and then, you know, now that competitions are on more often and they can hopefully make it to more of them, that they can continue to grow as a team. Because, yeah, they are still very young for a dance team. So that's the ice dance event.
Yeah, overall, it was an event. Not only that, but I feel bad that, like, a lot of their Olympic moments have been kind of overshadowed by, you know, the doping scandal that's kind of playing out. Like, the press conference was literally an hour after the free dance ended, so.
And I mean, a lot of people, I feel like, in general, like, ice dance isn't the most popular discipline for people to watch anyway. Right. A lot of people don't have the same emotional attachment to the discipline as they do for others, and, like, I totally get that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, definitely having that kind of dark cloud of the looming news over the top of this, of the free dance, definitely distracted from everything.
For sure.
Like, especially you had, like, the press conference for the medalists literally happening as the Court of Arbitration for Sport ruling was given out. Like, that was happening concurrently. So everything was just all over the place. But, like, again, this competition was quite predictable in the sense that it was very representative of the discipline that we have seen played out through the last couple of years. So yeah, it's still exciting to think about what the next season will bring, because there is going to be a lot of wiggle room at the top with how many retirements we're expecting. And I'm interested to see who's going to, like, step up to the plate in each respective federation. Like, I feel like the Grand Prix, especially next season, is going to be really interesting for ice dance. At least I hope it's going to be really interesting.
It'll be wide open again.
Exactly. I feel like I'm looking forward to see who takes that and runs with it for their momentum for the rest of the quad. So thank you for listening. We hope to see you again for our next episode, which will be about the women's event coming out soon, because, you know, we're recording this the day before the women's event is starting, so it'll be coming soon.
Thanks to our transcribing and quality control team, Evie, for editing as always, and Gab for our graphic designs.
If you want to get in touch with us, then please feel free to contact us via our website, inthelowpodcast.com, or on our Twitter. You can find our episodes on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify.
If you enjoy the show and want to help support the team, then please consider making a donation to us on our Ko-fi page. We would love to give a huge thank you to all the listeners who contributed to our team thus far. You can find the links to all our social pages and our Ko-fi on the website.
If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then please consider leaving a rating and review if you enjoyed the show. Thanks for listening. This has been Evie.
And Kat. Bye. Enjoy the rest of the
Olympics. See you guys. Have fun having little sleep.